Live from Dearborn, this is the Locked Tomb Podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
We are rereading Harrow the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. Today, we are covering chapters 50 all the way through the epilogue of Harrow the Ninth. So yeah, we're finishing Harrow the Ninth today, which is wild. Holy shit, it's been a ride.
Wow.
We're so happy to be getting this out before Nona arrives. Hopefully this should get to your eardrums right before Nona comes out. So hopefully you get a chance to listen to it before everything is answered and spoiled. But these chapters are actually some of the most interesting of the book, also the most confounding. We learn a lot about Wake and about both of the Gideons. John is casually murdered and then resurrected. Mercy is exploded. Augustine takes everyone for a dip in the river. Pyrrha is a thing now. And Harrow makes a choice, which honestly, I don't really even understand. And then finally, the epilogue. If you remember reading the epilogue the first time, I hope that you agree that it was just one huge what the fuck. Just a warning, we are coming at this as people who have already read the preview chapters of Nona that were released a few weeks ago. I mean, we've been mentioning this, I think, over the past couple of episodes, but especially at the end of this episode, if you don't want Nona spoiled at all and you want to go into it completely blind, then I mean, maybe just don't listen to this yet.
Yeah, and apologies if you already have, because if you made it this far, then we've spoiled the first six chapters of Nona for you.
Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, we don't know much. It's not like it spoils everything.
No. Amy, the other day I was flipping through...
Doug. Sorry. Pull yourself together.
I'm laughing at my own joke. It's so bad.
Tell me.
So the other day, I was flipping through some cohort files, and I was reading up on the different formations that they enact when they're about to quote-unquote steward a planet.
Yes.
And one of the formations is like where they line up in this really large grid. It's like 50 ships by 50 ships, if you can imagine it. And then for smaller planets, they have a smaller version of this formation.
Uh-huh.
Guess what the name of that smaller formation is.
What is it?
A griddle.
Oh my God. Why didn't I just say griddle?
I don't know, but a small grid in cohort speak is actually a griddle.
Oh my God, Mel, you're dying thinking about that.
I thought it was really good. But have no fear. Once again, I didn't just come up with a griddle joke. I started following the Fifth House, your favorite, on their official Instagram.
Oh.
And what do you think it's called when the Fifth House posts on their Insta?
What?
A pentogram.
Oh my God. Was this inspired by my pent pun on Twitter?
It sure was. I was so proud of you. We don't get anything more of pent in this book, so I had to drop her in here just a little bit.
I appreciate that. As my fantasy wife, I like that she's getting some credit.
Shall we get into it?
Let's freaking go. Chapter 50. We got an Eighth House skull. We're in the second first person, Gideon and Harrow. And I feel like the timestamp gets pretty important in these last couple chapters. So this is 30 minutes before the Emperor's murder.
Yeah. And so we start out with Ianthe leading Gideon to Jod's chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And as this is happening, there's a really good little Easter egg here where Gideon's talking about her reticence to see God. And she's basically saying in all of the comic books that she's read, typically whenever a character gets a letter from God, they're essentially being written out of the story.
Right.
Because they have to go serve the Prince Undying. And so she says she was irrationally convinced that with the act of seeing God, that was going to be the end of her story. And that space was being cleared for a new character.
Hmm.
Which is true.
Yeah.
There's definitely space being cleared for a new character. In any case, Gideon is not thrilled that Ianthe is taking her to see God.
Yeah, good point. I didn't really notice that. So when Ianthe and Gideon and Harrow show up at Jod's quarters, the door is open, which I guess was not expected. And they go in and hide behind this cloak in the corner behind the door. And they hear God talking to someone, and they see Kithareya's corpse tied to a chair. So basically all they can see is the back of Kithareya's corpse tied to a chair. I'm going to say one very small thing. Okay, in the book, they're listening to the people in this room, and someone that they can't see says, "Not a difficult question," someone said, without any particular concern. "It's not as though you have anything to hide. I just want to know how. Seriously, I'm more impressed than angry." But Moira Quirk in the audiobook reads this in Wake's voice, but I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be Jod.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Yes. So I will say, Moira Quirk, a true queen and someone I love deeply, can make very, very small mistakes. And I'm not going to say anything else about it.
Point taken. Point taken. Yeah, that's definitely God. We can all agree that that is meant to be God. So basically, you know, God is talking to this person who is in Kithareya's body and does refer to her as Commander Wake. Mm-hmm. And then Commander Wake responds and basically says, "You have to say my full name."
Right.
And God's like, fine. They kind of go back and forth. And what we learn is that Wake's full name is Awake Remembrance of These Valiant Dead. Kia Hua Ko Te Pai. Snap back to reality. Oops, there goes gravity. God, I just fucking love Tamsin Muir so much, if you didn't know. But essentially, Blood of Eden's naming conventions can be broken down into three parts. Tamsin Muir references this in a Reddit AMA. There's also a reference to Blood of Eden naming conventions in the back of the book, in the glossary, where it basically says it's made of three parts. They're always meant to reproduce an oral tradition that's passing down songs, poems, and otherwise extinct cultural references. Mm-hmm. But we don't actually know the formula of the naming convention. We just know that it has to include at least three cultural references. And there's tons of folks out there who think it's reference to Shakespeare, then your national anthem, and then an early 2000s song. So there's been a lot of stuff out there that people are like making up names. But in any case, the references here are fun. The Awake Remembrance of These Valiant Dead is a quote from a Shakespeare play, Henry V. The Kia Hua Ko Te Pai, I did my best on pronunciation there, means let goodness flourish. And it's a Te Reo line from Aotearoa. It's the indigenous name for New Zealand. And that line is from New Zealand's national anthem. Then snap back to reality, oops, there goes gravity, is obviously a line from Eminem's song Lose Yourself from 2002. And so I don't know about you, Amy, but I cannot wait to meet more Blood of Eden characters and learn what their full names are.
I know. I'm excited, too. I have to say that when I read Snap Back to Reality, Oops, There Goes Gravity, I think that more than any other like meme or reference in these books totally took me out of the book. Yeah. I read it and I was like, we both played a lot of sports. Did you not listen to that song constantly when you were playing sport ball?
Oh, yeah. And it definitely was on the warm-up
CD
for like my lacrosse game.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same.
Weird shit. I think this takes me out of the book because actually we technically exist in this universe. We are basically the Nine Houses past.
Right.
It's this weird thing where you're like, oh, this is a fantasy book, but also I'm very much in here.
Right.
And I don't know. It's weird.
It's very cool. Every time I read the snap back to reality bit, though, I'm like, oh, God.
Eminem, of all people, to quote here.
I know. And just to put this in context, Wake, who is in Kithareya's body, we finally confirm this, is charging Jod with crimes against humanity, basically. And he's like, oh, come on, tell me what you were doing. And John seems to think that Wake's mission is over. And I kind of get that impression, too. I feel like she wouldn't have let herself get caught like this if she didn't think her mission was over. Also, there's the bit where she sees, I guess, her own eyes in Harrow's face and doesn't shoot Harrow / Gideon.
I was confused by that. I thought Gideon had Electo's eyes that are actually God's eyes.
Both Wake and Electo have yellow eyes. And so when Mercy says lipochrome, recessive, it's because these
two people.
And that's how they figured out that, because it has to be two recessive.
Sixth grade biology. Thank you so much, Amy, for explaining that. I was so confused by this. Can you say it one more time in like a very succinct way?
Gideon got her eyes from Commander Wake and from God because they both had yellow eyes.
And lipochrome is the pigment for yellow eyes, and that's recessive. And if you are going to actually showcase a gene that is recessive, it has to be combined with another recessive trait. You remember those?
Yeah, the freaking Punnett square. Oh my God. It's like big L, little L. And Harrow got the two little L's.
Yes. Wow. What a throwback. I was probably learning about recessive genes when that Eminem song came out in 2002.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyways, so I think the reason that Wake didn't shoot Harrow, which I feel like if Harrow had had her normal black eyes, she definitely would have shot Harrow. But I think that in that moment, she must have realized that somehow this was her kid who she knows was on the ninth house. Anyway, I do feel like in this moment, I have the impression that Wake has gotten some sort of confirmation, or for some reason feels like her mission is over. I'm not really sure why. But I mean, John's trying to figure it out too.
Right. And he says, Wake, Blood of Eden died with you. Mm-hmm. You never would have fired nukes into my fleet. So you remember way back, the whole reason why they're on the Mithraeum, I mean, other than to escape these resurrection beasts, but they need to regroup and let the cohort fight Blood of Eden, because Blood of Eden killed, I don't know, 18,000 cohort folks. And I found this interesting. I don't know. There's so much depth to each of these characters, and we get it through these little anecdotes. But in God saying that Wake never would have done that, I was catching up on some parts of the back of this book, and there is a Blood of Eden memorandum in the back of the book that says, you know, one of their two objectives is actually to minimize allied casualties.
Right.
Because it's not worth sacrificing BOE personnel. So this is like a more conservative approach to their warfare. And Wake's not in charge anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We Suffer is in charge of one of the cells. They're also, we find out much later that there's actually quite a few different branches of Blood of Eden. And as with any religion or political party or whatever, there's always going to be more radical factions than others. Right. And they're going to take different approaches. And so part of this is very much like the version of Blood of Eden that Wake was the leader of died. It has changed. And so Wake is not as relevant to them anymore. I don't know how true that actually is, but that's what John is trying to say here.
Right. And he's trying to get her to tell him why she went to the ninth house 19 years ago. He's like, well, you could have gone to the third house and done a lot of damage, but you chose to go to my smallest house in the middle of nowhere. This is also the bit where he says, you skipped the dummy target in the atmosphere. You found the exact coordinates for the house. And I assume he's referring to the prison.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the whole function of the prison is as a dummy target, and then also maybe to let the cohort keep an eye on the ninth.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like this is our second reference to the prison in this whole book, or maybe the third, but it's weird that it came back here in this way as just like, oh, it's a decoy.
Right. So maybe we'll see the prison in the future.
Prison and melons.
It does say at the end of Harrow, like the very last thing says, the tomb will open in Electo the ninth. So we'll see. They'll be back in the ninth house eventually. And then there's an interesting thing that Wake says where she says, necromancy is a disease you released and it needs to be purged. And I think this is interesting. Hopefully we learn more about the actual origins of necromancy. I think we will. Yeah, so she blames John for basically starting this disease. And he replies saying, don't say purge. They're like baby necromancers too. You don't want to kill them, do you? And she says, how many babies died in the bomb, Gaius? And he says, all of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this basically confirms what I think we've mostly assumed. Honestly, God has communicated to Hera in so many words that he wiped out humanity because it needed to happen.
According to him.
According to him. And then there was a resurrection. With any act, there's always a reaction, and the reaction is necromancy as a result.
Right.
But now, just in this simple dialogue, we kind of get the picture of BOE is trying to essentially cleanse the universe of necromancy, and that is their mission.
Right.
And so God is really just trying to keep getting information from Wake, trying to understand how she got here. Obviously, this must be quite surprising for him.
Right.
And as they're having this conversation, who walks into the room but Augustine and Mercy Morn? And as you all should remember, they probably just found each other because Augustine ran into Gideon and Hera's body, saw the eyes, freaked out, ran away to find Joy because he thought that Gideon was Electo.
Right.
Also, while this is all happening, Anthy and Gideon are just hiding in a corner behind a curtain, which I find like hilarious. I find it funny that no one here even notices their presence. But anyway, Augustine and Mercy Morn show up, and they essentially at this point have pieced together that God has lied to them. And this is them showing up to confront him. They have no idea that Commander Wake is sitting right here when they burst in.
Yeah, they don't know that it's already a total shit show.
It's like a shit show layered cake up in here.
Yeah, it's a shit cake. Okay, so Augustine and Mercy walk into this shit show, and they kind of come in guns blazing. Mercy's like, it's all come out. It's taken 10,000 years, but it's all come out. And John is very obnoxious and coy when he's like, I don't want to be flip, but am I in trouble?
God, he's such an asshole.
I wanted to punch him in the face.
As he makes this flip comment, he's like, you know, maybe this isn't the time for y'all to come in and lay on me whatever it is you're going to lay on me. Like, look who's here. And he introduces Augustine and Mercy Morn to Commander Wake. And Commander Wake is like, wow, I get to really blow this shit wide open now. And Commander Wake's like, oh, yeah, no, we know each other.
Yeah. And then Augustine and Mercy and Wake have a conversation where God's listening to them argue. Wake is like, you guys totally fucked me over. All of the dummies that Mercy made died. I had to impregnate myself. She says only the sample was still active. So, I mean, God has some sort of thalergetic power as well. So it's clear that Wake, Augustine, and Mercy had a deal where Wake would do the baby thing and help evacuate the houses. I think probably if Augustine and Mercy killed God. That was probably the exchange. I can't imagine what else would have motivated Wake enough to do this borderline suicidal thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that was the exchange. There's just some really good, like, oh, moments throughout Wake and Augustine and Mercy Morn's dialogue where Augustine and Mercy are like, yo, where have you been for 20 years? Like, you just totally disappeared on us. And Wake's like, fuck you. I've been in that fucking hole this whole time, referring to the nine houses. And I think we referenced in our last episode, she says, at first I was in my bones, then a blade, and then in that fucking hole. And so, again, when Wake died, her revenant inhabited her bones, and then she jumped from the bones to that two-hander.
Right.
And they're going back and forth about double-crossing each other, and Mercy's like, wow, I can't believe you impregnated yourself with God's sperm. You weren't supposed to do that. And Wake says, yo, I do what I can. Like, I do what I have to because I'm so passionate for the cause.
Yeah, anything for the revolution.
As they have this back and forth, God does that weird time thing again where he's like, stop. And everyone stops. Gideon describes what she's tasting when this happens. Mm-hmm. So we know God has some sort of power over making people stop.
Right.
We don't totally know what it is, but it's weird because Gideon can literally taste something in the air. And she says it's even more than a theorem. She doesn't know what it is, but God obviously has all these extra powers.
Yeah. And he says, so the plan was to kill a lictor's baby at the mouth of the tomb to start a Thanergy cascade in order to open the door. And he says, you know, it never would have worked. You know, it wouldn't have worked. And it's in this moment that Gideon the First shows up and actually does see Gideon and Ianthe hiding behind the robe. Gideon the First moves the robe to the side, takes the aviators off of Harrow's face and kind of grimaces like, sorry, and puts them on his face and walks into the argument that the lictors and God and Wake are having. There's a really, 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 really incredible line where Gideon is describing her relationship to Kithareah / Wake as Kithareah's body sort of turns around to look at Gideon the First entering the room. And Gideon Nav says, the woman I was pretty sure was actually my mother, wearing the body of a woman I'd had a crush on, who in turn had been wearing the identity of a woman she'd murdered until I fell on a spike so that my boss could kill her, craned her head around in her bonds. In summation.
God, it's so good. And you read this and you're like, yeah, no wonder I had no idea what was fucking going on in this book. But yeah, this is a really helpful summary, you know. Mm-hmm. This person, Wake, in Kithareah's body, turns, and it says for the first time she smiled, and that it was a smile for your old cellmate who just landed back in prison. Or, more correctly, the smile of someone stepping out of jail after serving a very long sentence, having seen someone there waiting for her. Someone whose presence meant total reprieve. And Gideon describes the smile as a smile that said, you came back for me. And right after that, Gideon the First shoots Wake in the back of the head. And you're like, what?
Yeah, he just walks in, shoots her in the head, and like, that's that. I love the description of the smile. I was in Safeway today, and I was listening to the audiobook of this part, and I was in the Safeway bathroom, and I like was trying to do the smile in the mirror, and then a bunch of teens walked in. So,
Amy, that is the funniest shit I have ever heard. But actually, a really good exercise. There are so many great descriptions of people's facial expressions throughout these books. We could spend so many hours trying to recreate them with our own faces. That is so funny. Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of embarrassing. But
was it Jean-Marie and Isaac who walked in?
Might as well have been. So Gideon the First shoots Kithareah's corpse / Wake in the head, presumably destroying the spirit. And I assume that, well, Pyrrha actually did this so that Wake wouldn't be forced to answer questions, right? That's that whole exchange.
Yeah, I have thought about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But right, this is now Pyrrha and Gideon the First body, which we don't actually know yet on our first read through.
Yes.
But Pyrrha probably doesn't want any of them to know that it's now Pyrrha and Gideon the First body as well. And Wake would probably be able to tell because Wake and Pyrrha had an affair and still in Gideon the First body. So I think some of this is like self-preservation. And then another part of it might literally be mercy for Wake.
Right. We don't know what Jod could have done to her, but he seems to think that he can get her to answer questions. But I feel like her dusty, you came back for me smile makes it seem like she was like, oh, thank God. I know who this is. This person's going to know exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tiny little bit of me that was like, you know what? Wake has been kicked out of so many different things and moved through so many different things. And all you need is like contact, right? So I was like, what if Pyrrha was getting Wake's spirit in this gun? And then I was like, that seems really complicated. But I just will put it out there so that I feel really smart if that's the case.
I never thought about that. But at first I was like, no way, that's not it. But I could totally see that. I could totally see that happening.
I just don't trust that anyone's ever actually dead in this world.
Right.
I'm like, prove it, prove it.
Right. And that's a big relief because there's a lot of people who die, sort of.
Mm-hmm. So after getting the first slash, Pyrrha shoots Wake slash Kithorea. This is so confusing. In the head, God's like, come on, dude. I had a lot of questions to ask her. He seems peeved, but not furious. And he's like, Gideon, did you know that when you caught up to Wake and kicked her out of that airlock that she was pregnant? And Gideon's like, I was aware. And God's like, why didn't you tell me? And Gideon slash Pyrrha says, because I thought it was mine. And everyone freaks out.
Everyone's reaction is so good. Mercy Morn's reaction is like, ugh, really grossed out. Augustine just laughs, but in that laugh, an unbelievable, like, oh my God, of course. Like, this is ridiculous.
Right.
I don't know about you, but when I read this, it's just so funny. Because I feel like at this point in the book, Tamsin Muir's like, how much weird shit can I just keep piling on where I'm like entangling everyone in these really weird, fucked up relationships? It's just so good.
I know. So John's like, what the fuck? And Gideon Sr. says, forgive me, John, I didn't know anything about it. And the narration says that was a weird thing to say. And it is a weird thing to say, but we find out shortly why. But we'll move on. So at this point, Mercy and Augustine explain that the plan was to use God's kid to spoof the Blood Ward and get into the tomb. And this was their plan, Dios Apate Major, the original threesome that they had with God. And God's like, wait, that's impossible. What the hell? And Augustine's every explanation is just Mercy Morn, Mercy Morn. Because I think, well, we won't go too into it.
No, we have to go in. Amy, we have to go into this. It's like hilarious and important. So,
okay.
So like, basically, God's like, it's a blood war. What did you expect to do? Just murder this baby and have a thanergetic cascade happen? And they were like, no, dude, we talked to Cassiopeia at one point, and Cassiopeia shared a very interesting fact about blood wards, and that is that they should really be called cell wards because they work off thalergetic enzymes, which can be spoofed with a substantial thanergy burst and the blood of a close relative, for example, a parent or a child. Essentially, you don't need the person whose blood ward it is to open the blood ward. You just need a relative of theirs. And so, again, their whole plan is revealed that they wanted to make a baby to spoof God's blood ward.
Right.
And God's like, yeah, but he would have had to get my sperm. And then he's like, oh, because 20 years ago, the saint of patience and the saint of joy planned for 500 years how they would have a threesome with God so that they could take his sperm and make a baby. And so that was called Dios Apate Major, which, as we recall, means the deceit of God. Mm-hmm. And God's like, yeah, but I didn't. And it cuts off. And he's saying, like, I didn't ejaculate. And even though God didn't finish, Mercy Morn was still able to extract it because she's Mercy Morn. And she's memorized the whole body and is an anatomist and a very good one. So the emperor's like, wow, so fine. Wake had my baby, but the baby must have died en route because Gideon the First got to her. And Mercy Morn's like, no, it didn't die.
It's at this moment that Gideon and Hera's body comes out of hiding and says, I'm not fucking dead. And Jod looks at her and says, hi, not fucking dead. I'm dad, which is a meme.
What is the meme?
It can be anything. Like someone says, I'm hungry. And the dad says, hi, hungry, I'm dad. I think that's probably like the original. Is there another more original meme that this is based on? That's what I knew of.
No, I was hunting around for it and I couldn't figure it out. But it's the best dad joke ever. And
I knew you would like it.
It is also the best way possible for this confusing ass chapter to end. I don't know. It's so funny. This whole chapter is really funny. It's also really complicated. So if we were a total mess trying to reread that back to you all, it's not our fault.
So we move straight into chapter 51, which just kind of continues the same conversation. We've got an eighth house skull, first and second person, Gideon and Harrow's body. But at the very beginning of this chapter, we get a little bit of an interlude where Gideon's reminiscing or remembering her childhood and her relationship with her dead mother. Basically, she would do all these really cute, sad things, like pretend that different skeletons that were tending the leek fields were her mom, and she would go and hang out by her mom's niche. And one time, Harrow caught Gideon telling her mom's bones, I love you, and obviously mocked her for this. And they fought so hard that Harrow had Gideon's face under her fingernails, so she was all bloody from tearing up Gideon's face. And Gideon says, were you 10, Harrow? Was I 11? I think implying that this is the moment where Harrow decided to kill herself and open the tomb. But instead of dying, because she had Gideon's blood on her hands, she was able to open the tomb.
Yeah, and there's a really heart-wrenching way that Gideon finishes this little inner monologue where she says, you remember how the fuck-off great aunts always used to say, suffer and learn? If they were right, Nona Jesimus, how much more can we take until you and me achieve omniscience?
Right.
Gideon, her whole life, has been treated like shit. She's been wondering who her parents are. What was her mom like? She never got to know her. Who was her dad? Was he ever going to come for her? You know, all these things. And then just to find out that you were meant as a tool, as a bomb, as Wake referred to Gideon when Gideon was in the womb. And that's fucking heartbreaking. Because at the very least, if you don't know your parents, you can build them up to be whatever it is that you want them to be. And now she knows who they are. And it's fucking rough.
It is. It's really sad. She's been through so much. And, you know, we've said this before, but it's amazing that she's so freaking great and kind and good.
It is really totally bonkers.
Especially as the offspring of two complete douchebags.
Yeah, it's almost like Gideon got the best of both of these douchebags.
Yeah.
She got Wake's ability to just be a kick-ass fighter. And she got God's sense of humor.
Yeah. And I think that she got her drive and her passion from both of them, too.
Yeah.
And we move back into the room where God is having this conversation with Augustine and Mercy, mourning Gideon the First and Gideon Nav in Harrow's body.
Where essentially Mercy Morn describes it's the eyes, your child Electo's eyes. And God flinches at Mercy Morn saying, Electo. And Mercy Morn says, Electo, 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 three times. Everyone flinches. And then she says, John, you're trying to start a fight with me to get out of the fight I'm trying to have with you, which is a painfully domestic tactic. A couple Easter eggs here. One, Electo, Electo, Electo. Call back to when she said, Ortis, Ortis, Ortis. Uh-huh. And then another funny thing is that this sentence she says about God trying to start a fight with her, actually John says this exact thing to Mercy Morn in one of the very first chapters
on the shuttle.
It's just fun. It brings a story full circle in a really cool way,
right?
And grounds us in an otherwise very wild plot that's going on right now.
Right. So Mercy accuses God of, you know, I guess they thought that Electo was just his bodyguard, but she was actually his cavalier. And that's why she has his eyes and he actually has hers. And God's like, I told you the truth about everything. There could be any number of explanations for this. Why would I have not told you the truth about this? And Augustine's like, you couldn't get her to lie. The only reason you told us the truth is that Alecto was incapable of lying. And he calls her a monster. And John weirdly says, don't call her that. Which is funny because when he has that one conversation with Harrow earlier in the book, he said he buried a monster. So a little bit hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
And then Augustine replies with a thing that I've thought about a lot. He says, a monster, John. She was a bloody monster in a human suit. She was a monster the moment you resurrected her, and you went and made her worse. Is he referring to the fact that he made her his cavalier, or is it something else? In what way did John make her worse?
I don't know. I feel like we could speculate about this for a long time.
Probably.
I think that one potential theory is that he says she was a bloody monster in a human suit. There's a hint here where when Augustine says she was incapable of lying.
Right.
In Nona, actual Nona says that she is incapable of lying. And so this gives us a little bit of a clue that Nona might actually be Alecto. I think a lot of us think that. I think that. But that's one reason here is why I think Nona is Alecto in Harrow's body, because of this exact moment and connection around not being able to lie. I wonder if Alecto was in a different form and that making her worse meant John tried to make Alecto more human, which threw a lot of people off because Alecto is not really human. We don't fully know what Alecto actually is. We think she's maybe the 10 billion souls in one or something. But I wonder if by trying to make her more palatable to everyone, he did something to her and made her right. even worse. I don't know what that means.
Because we think that she's probably the 9th resurrection beast, right?
So what we think. We had someone write in recently, and I'm not going to do their theory justice, and we want to hold some of this for a later episode, but a question around if Nona or Alecto is a resurrection beast, why didn't she drive them mad? Right, that was the question behind the theory that maybe Alecto's not really a resurrection beast, because the way that all the other resurrection beasts relate to the lictors is that they drive them mad. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about that forever. But I do feel like she was obviously different. If she is a resurrection beast, she's very different than the other resurrection beasts. They also talk about how they asked God to put her down because they thought that the resurrection beasts were coming partially for her, which I don't really know why. But I mean, I think we'll probably find out in approximately like 3 days.
Right. I do think that they are coming for her because she is John's cavalier. She is John and John is Alecto, right? One flesh, one end and all that shit. And I think that up until this moment, the lictors didn't actually know that Alecto is God's cavalier, right? And so this is what they've come to realize is like who Alecto actually is in relation to God.
Right. And God says, finally, summarize, please. You both do tend to go overboard on the foreplay. LOL. And Augustine says, the eyes have it, John, which is not really a meme, but it's a reference to Parliament. Clever. And they say, there's no possible way that Alecto's genetic code is in a baby in the 9th house, but it's super likely that your genetic code is, because Mercy Morn and Augustine worked very hard to get it there. And so the only explanation for a God's baby having yellow eyes is that God's actual eyes are yellow and he's switched them with Alecto. There's one really interesting thing that Mercy says. There's no possible way Alecto's genetic code, to the extent that she even had one, which, by the way, I'm not convinced she ever did. Presumably she's a human. At least her body is like a human, no matter what is stuffed in there. Sometimes I feel like there's more hard science behind this than we really realize yet. And maybe we'll learn more about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so they talk about how in Mercy and Augustine explaining how they arrived at this realization, Mercy describes how they begged God to kill her. He eventually says that she's as dead as I can make her. and God was very upset. And Mercy says that you really wanted to honor her, and so you made her a tomb and you set Anastasia to guard it. And sure, fine, that made sense. You're mourning your bodyguard, whatever. She was with you from the beginning, fine. But what really didn't make sense was you. And God says, what about me? And Augustine says, you told me to perfect how to map power. And so I did that. And what I discovered is that you don't get your power from Dominicus. It gets its power from you, and that there's no exchange involved, no symbiosis, which is really weird because in this universe, there's always a give and a take. And so it's very strange that Dominicus is getting its power from God, but God isn't getting anything back. And so, like, what is it that's actually powering God? And him and Mercy Morn, through conversation, talk about, like, well, I wonder what God's actually afraid of. Oh, he's afraid of AL. And they start thinking, oh, what if he didn't actually put her down? What if she's still alive? But why would he keep her alive? Unless she needed to be alive because she is God's cavalier.
Right. And I don't know if they guessed that she was his cavalier, that somehow he just got his power from her. But this is the whole reason that they wanted to break into the tomb, to answer this question for themselves. At this point, John confirms that this happened. Augustine asks him if Anastasia actually got it right. And God says that she did. So actually, Anastasia was the only one who attempted true lictorhood, perfect lictorhood, and John, it sounds like, shut her down. And he continues and asks what he can do to be forgiven, and Augustine says, stop your mission, John. Give up on the thing I know you've been looking for since the very beginning. Stop expanding. Stop assembling this bewildering cartography, this invasion force. And he says, nobody has to be punished anymore for what happened to humanity. And this makes me wonder, what is God's plan? What is he assembling? Where is he trying to go? Is there some enclave of the original rich people who ran away that are hidden out somewhere and he wants to get to them? Is that the plan? And he's conquering all these planets to force them to be soldiers for the nine houses? Again, I think we'll find out a lot more, but it's an interesting look into God's motivations.
Right. And it seems a lot more complicated than just hunting down Blood of Eden. Maybe that is all it is. But why continue to go out and invade planet after planet after planet and fold all of those people into the nine houses? Why do that? Why is that necessary? Way back, Augustine, I think, had shared that from what he can tell, John's just being vindictive. Which might actually be true, or it could be a little bit more layered and complicated than that. And so we will find that out, I'm sure.
Finally, Mercy Morn says that she'll forgive God if he'll just answer her truthfully. And she asks him to confirm basically that he loved the Cavaliers and that he didn't want anything bad to happen to them and that he lied. And Mercy Morn says, I forgive you everything, Lord. And then she sinks her hand inside of him and takes him apart. Like, every single bit of him just disintegrates. Every atom separates from every atom. It's not even really an explosion or anything like that. It just looks like he kind of dissipates. And I assume that the reason that Mercy Morn was actually studying anatomy was for this very moment, right?
Right. And I think as she is about to approach God and commit this murderous act, Augustine looks at her and then just sinks to the ground against the wall because he knows what she's about to do. And he doesn't do anything to stop her. I will also say that something that God says to Mercy Morn when she asks him to fess up and that then she'll forgive him, he says there's actually no such thing as forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
And Mercy Morn seemingly convinces him otherwise. But God hasn't forgiven anyone. I mean, whatever this mission actually is, this is 10,000 years of God not forgiving anyone.
Right.
And so I think that's why God genuinely doesn't believe in forgiveness, is because he doesn't actually forgive. And when this wild murder happens, and it's written really beautifully, Mercy Morn turns around to Augustine and says, "It is finished," which has come up before. If you'll recall, in Gideon, it was written on the whiteboard in the laboratory, "It is finished."
Oh, great callback.
Which is also, right, a biblical reference. And the chapter closes with Gideon saying, "Well, I am left as an orphan once again, but I'm not really going to think about that too hard." Yep. And so amidst all of this aha and the story coming together, we can't forget the like emotional toll this is taking on our beloved Gideon.
I know, poor baby. Thankfully, chapter 52 just continues right on from where we left off. We have a fifth house skull. We're still in the first and second person Gideon and Harrow's body perspective. Mercy Morn and Augustine have a moment together. Mercy Morn says that she felt like she had to be the one to do it. And then she starts to explain that in killing God, she's killed the nine houses. The sun will explode and make a black hole that no one in the system will escape. And Gideon's like, "Well, we got to go save them." And she's like, "Oh, we don't have time." And Ianthe says, "You're not even going to try?"
Yeah.
Which would be out of character, except that I can only assume that what she's concerned about is her sister potentially being in the system.
I mean, totally. That was my take on this, is that Ianthe's like, "Oh, shit, my best friend and person I love most is going to die, and I'm with the person who did it." I also think this is just like, on the ranking of who has the least amount of morals and ethics, I think this places Mercy Morn definitely below Ianthe.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like Mercy Morn's ethics are very complicated after 10,000 years, but I don't think she was ever a good person. And in fact, here, she admits that she's never been very nice and she's never been very good. And we're like, yeah.
Yeah, no shit. No shit. It is this wild thing that Mercy Morn felt that it was appropriate to murder God in this moment. And well, oh well, all the nine houses are going to die now. That is like, that's a lot. That is a lot.
It is. She even says, "Now I'm going to go die." And Augustine's like, "No, you're not. We're actually going to go round up cohort ships that are out of the system. There are plenty of people from the nine houses that are still going to survive this, and we're going to go find them and find a new home." And Mercy Morn's like, "That wasn't the plan." And Augustine says, "You're going to have to put up with the fact that you picked the wrong man to enter into a suicide pact with. I hate him. Christabel might have undone all my good work with Alfred, but here comes the reckoning." And this is the moment where I think when I first read it, I was like, oh, that's what happened between Christabel and Alfred.
Right. We've been referring to the suicide pact that Christabel and Alfred made throughout these books, and how Augustine has really held that against Mercy Morn for all of these years. And I feel like this is the moment on the ranking of who has the least amount of ethics and morals that Mercy Morn also then falls beneath Augustine. Mm-hmm. Here, because Augustine's very much like, yo, we have to like clean up what we can. We're not just gonna tap out now and go kill ourselves and just let people figure it out. It's actually our responsibility to do what we can to set folks up for success, and then we can tap out.
Right.
But we're not doing that yet. And I wrote here, so is Augustine like a good person in this moment? He's definitely better than Mercy Morn. I don't know what the selfish motivation would be behind Augustine's actions here. This actually seems like he genuinely wants to help.
I just feel like, imagine living 10,000 years. Your motivations and morals are so layered at that point. I don't know if I actually think Augustine is better than Mercy. I don't know if we can make a ranking of morality. They're all shitty. And they've probably always been shitty, but they're also like, they've basically been in trauma land for 10,000 years. So
right.
Their brains are fried.
Right. And so there's a reference here I want to make sure we catch because you referenced it many episodes ago. Uh-huh. And here is our moment. Basically, Augustine turns to Gideon Sr. and says, all right, no retribution, Gideon. Aren't you mad at us? Basically, because Gideon's been God's pet this whole time.
Attack dog.
Yeah, attack dog. And Gideon says, no retribution. And Augustine says, wow, like, I'd be lying if I say I wasn't surprised. Here we three are at the end, Alpha, Beta, and Gamma.
Right. And it continues with Gideon stared at the dead cigarette in his hand, and then he said, well, Augustine, there's something you should know. And this is the moment, we had two different interpretations of this, but this is the moment that I thought that Pyrrha, who's actually in Gideon's body, is about to tell Augustine that Gideon the First is dead and that it's actually her, Pyrrha.
I did think Augustine knew that it was Pyrrha earlier. Mm-hmm. And this seems to suggest that that's probably not true, that Pyrrha is about to confess that she's Pyrrha and that Gideon the First is dead, right? Which would suggest that Augustine didn't actually know that Pyrrha was alive.
And it's not like confirmed 100%, but I feel like this is pretty good evidence that it would be a surprise to Augustine. I am still confused about how no one was like, why can't Gideon the First heal as quickly as everyone else? But whatever.
They're just all so self-involved. They're not paying attention.
It's at this moment when Pyrrha and Gideon, the First's body, says, well, Augustine, there's something you should know, that once again, time stops. And in the middle of the room, all of these little pieces of stuff start gathering and forming this body kind of from the inside out. It's really cool how it's described. And it says that it took 2 seconds, it took a myriad, but at the end of this reassembly of a body, Jod is once again standing there and he's right behind Mercy and he immediately steps forward and blows her heart out.
Which is so crazy. I don't know about you, Amy, but when I first read this, I was totally not expecting that at all. It's like one thing to have God resurrected, fine. It's another for him without any discussion after everything, after getting to know Mercy more and throughout this whole book, for her to die so suddenly like that at his hand. At least even with how Mercy killed God, there was like dialogue leading up to it. And then she touches him and then kind of blows him up. It feels way less jarring, whereas this is basically as jarring as it was when Gideon the First walked in the room and blew Wake's neck out.
Right. It happens extremely quickly. And this is the moment also where I feel like all of a sudden we see God for who he truly is, which is Eovul, extraordinarily powerful, and Beovul, actually, like, as Augustine said, never as sentimental as he seems.
Yeah, it's like his mask is off and he's like, all right, well, I'm going to get down to business right now. Mm-hmm. He murders Mercy Morn right away and he says, all right, the sun has stabilized. Hope the sixth house didn't get cooked in the flare.
Once again.
Again.
Mercury.
A reference. Yep, Mercury. And he's basically like, you know, that was cool, like a lovely bit of work that, you know, Mercy Morn did. I guess she must have been training for like 1,000 years or something to figure that one out. But I didn't get to where I am by being able to die, you know? Again, just kind of demonstrating how much more powerful God is even than a lictor who studied something for 1,000 years. Yeah. He's just able to undo just like that. He also fucking reveals here that resurrection beasts can't kill him.
Right. And it's funny because this is kind of like what Augustine takes from this. He's like, wait, you said you were afraid of resurrection beasts. And God's like, no, they can't kill me. And Augustine says, like, you were acting afraid. And it is, I have a lot of thoughts and we don't really have time to go through them all, but I have a lot of thoughts about why God never faced the resurrection beasts. I think he's probably right. It looks like he could have become alive again immediately after dying. But I do wonder a couple of things. One, I wonder if he had the resurrection beasts, he didn't want to fight them and kill them immediately because he kind of was using them to distract his lictors. I think we've mentioned this before. Or two, that for some reason he can't fight in the river, or like there's something about him being in the river that's not super groovy, although they've been in the river before. So for some reason, God has let his lictors die one by one fighting these giant monsters that apparently he could have fought himself without being harmed.
Yeah, I think dick move is a really understated way of saying what this is. I'm just like, what? Also, y'all, this has been going on for 10,000 years. Fun fact about me, I'm like Electo. I cannot lie. I am so bad at it. And in fact, if I tell a lie, I then keep myself up at night thinking about it, and then I just come clean. Like, I can't do that. This man slash God has kept so many lies in secrets for 10,000 years. What kind of dude is this? I guess one who would just blow up 10 billion people,
right?
Because he felt like it was the only option, and he felt like he had the authority and moral righteousness to do that. Man, this man is the worst. And so even after he says this, and like, I don't know about you, if I were Gideon or Augustine, I'd be so mad. He essentially asks everyone for their loyalty. He's like, all right, I don't like to clean house all at once, but we got to do what we got to do. And he says, Gideon episode one.
Yeah.
Whatever about Wake, no worries that you had an affair with her. But like, do you have my loyalty? And Pyrrha in Gideon the first body immediately says, yes, you have my loyalty. Then he asks Ianthe, and Ianthe says, yes, you have my loyalty. So these two are like real quick. Obviously, at least to me, they're just trying to save their own hides right now. They know that they are no match for God. They don't want to die. They have self-preservation in mind. Of course, they're going to say like, sure, you have my loyalty.
Right. I think Pyrrha just wants to survive, and Ianthe is playing some sort of long game.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also the point where when God is asking Gideon the first if he'll swear his loyalty to him, he says, I'm not even mad that you failed to fix or put down Harrow. And so when he gets to Gideon Nav and Harrow's body, Gideon Nav is like, what the fuck? It was you who ordered Gideon the first to try and kill Harrow? And God's like, I'm not going to have this argument with you. It was for her own good. And just throws Gideon Nav with his mind powers across the room and moves on to Augustine. And God asks Augustine if he'll swear his loyalty and kind of begs him to come back into the fold in a way. And Augustine has this moment of thought, and then he says, no, John, and he drops the whole Mithraeum into the river, like deep into the river.
Right, which is notable because I think way back at one of the dinners,
mm-hmm.
God says something like, oh, Augustine can drop like a whole city into the river or something, and Augustine's like, no, I can't.
Right.
And here we go. Not only has God been deceitful, but Augustine clearly has been hiding the power that he holds.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I imagine this scene that's about to come up, I imagine it in an IMAX theater with crazy good sound effects.
Oh, yeah.
And like when Augustine drops the Mithraeum into the river, it's like that. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know. I gotta find a clip.
But okay, I'm not sure what if you're
like,
blah, when really
it's like bleh. Anyway, this then turns into just another fucking epic battle, but a battle that's totally different than any other battle that we've seen in these books so far. And it is just brilliantly written, unsurprisingly. And the imagination and creativity that had to go into this half of this chapter is just astounding.
So, first of all, Augustine, God, Ianthe are pulled out into the river. And Gideon Nav is weirdly pulled back and saved by Gideon the First, who kind of takes her out of the room. And Gideon can see Augustine and God and Ianthe sort of falling in the water outside. But she's safe, at least for the moment, inside an inner corridor on the Mithraeum. And Gideon's like, are you not going to do anything? You're a necromancer. And Gideon the First says, my necromancer is dead. And we learn that this is actually Pyrrha, Gideon the First's cavalier, who has been living kind of in Gideon's subconscious for 10,000 years. And Gideon the First has just died fighting number 7. And so now Pyrrha is at the helm, which is, I mean, truly mind-blowing. A couple things that I noticed in this bit. First of all, it is weird that John and Augustine, it looks like they're wrestling in the water, but they're not actually seeming to do necromancy. But Ianthe's doing necromancy, so I'm a little bit confused about what's going on here.
I thought that Augustine was doing necromancy to, like, fight with God.
Right.
You could interpret this in a couple different ways. The one way is that John maybe isn't able to use his power in the river in the same way. That could be layered with Augustine actually is using necromancy in some way that's preventing God from being able to enact his full power. And so there's a struggle happening between God and Augustine, and clearly God isn't able to access the power that he typically has.
Right. Another thing I noticed in this bit when Pyrrha is kind of revealing herself is that she explains that she and Gideon the First compartmentalized from the Eightfold Word, and that he didn't even know that she was in there. And she compares herself to Gideon Harrow, and she says, he took more from me than got taken from you, which I thought was curious. It seems to be, at least in Nona, that Pyrrha is like a full person. So I wonder what exactly Gideon the First took from her that she's referring to here. So anyway,
when Pyrrha is describing how she and Gideon have compartmentalized, she tells Gideon that actually she had been having an affair with Wake as well.
Right.
Which is fascinating that Wake, again, for someone who poo-poos necromancy in a really real way, in that she's leading these forces to try and get rid of it, is having an affair with both a necromancer and his cavalier in the same body. That is just, I mean, that is wild.
She hates bones, but she loves boning.
Wow, is that our first boning joke of our
podcast? It might be, which is
podcast?
Mind-blowing. But that one's for you, Mel. That one's for Thanks. You.
Thanks. And Pyrrha says, Wake was the most dangerous woman I'd ever met who wasn't me. And like, yeah, she was a real dick. So anyway, this is like a little bit of a reveal. And also in terms of character building for Pyrrha as we move into Nona, mm-hmm. is like understanding that Pyrrha has been influenced by Wake.
Right.
How radicalized, we don't fully know, but radicalized enough that she like also doesn't really vibe with God and sees that a lot is wrong here. And so worth mentioning because it's part of what makes Pyrrha who Pyrrha is when we get to Nona.
Yeah, I also feel like your best friend killing you and you being stuffed in the back of his brain for 10,000 years probably like doesn't make you super pro that system.
That too. It's not like Pyrrha was one of the ones who had the suicide pact. We don't know how willing Pyrrha was to like do the Eightfold Word with and like have Gideon become a lictor. Like we don't know what that actual relationship was. Did she go willingly or not? But at the very least, with this big reveal that actually that didn't have to happen, if she hadn't been radicalized before, she would be now.
Right. So Pyrrha and Gideon Nav are looking down at Augustine and John having this silent water fight in the river, and the stoma have opened on the bottom of the river. So they're all the way down in the Barathrum. And the stoma are nasty. They're really, really gross. They're like human mouths with big teeth and these like human tongues.
Yeah, they're disgusting. They're reminiscent of when the Eighth House was fighting Ianthe and Colum became some weird spirit situation.
Holy shit.
So we talked a long time ago about how the Eighth House soul siphoning is somehow related to
the stoma.
The stoma. And the actual description of the stoma here very much mirrors exactly what happened when Colum became a demon or whatever. And so we get another tie that soul siphoning is related to the stoma. It is equally as disgusting. It's so nasty. This imagery is so good that it's also like so bad. And Pyrrha seems to be somewhat surprised that the stoma is opening for John. What are the implications of this, right? We know that the stoma opens for resurrection beasts. And we learned that, I think, when we had like River Bubble 201 or something like that.
Also, Pyrrha says it must think that he's a resurrection beast.
Exactly. And so if he's attained perfect lictorhood with Electo, this could be an argument that Electo actually is a resurrection beast in that one flesh, one end. If Electo's a resurrection beast, then there is something of a resurrection beast also within John that is causing the stoma to open.
Right. That was my read. And as they're watching this battle, Gideon Nav is kind of like, okay, well, what are we going to do? And Pyrrha says that they can wait inside and be crushed. They can swim and get eaten by ghosts or sucked down to the stoma, or they can shoot themselves with her revolver. And then, I don't know if it's right away or a bit later, but she says, your mother would have chosen the bullet. And Gideon replies, yes, well, jail for mother, which is one of the funniest fucking memes in this whole book. If you don't know the jail for mother meme,
just Google it. There's a cat involved. I mean,
there are like several think pieces about this meme.
Yeah. Regardless of the meme, these options are bad. Gideon is not her mother.
Right.
You, as a child of someone, do not have to become your parent. And so here we have Gideon, who was never really Wake, but who has a choice here. It's not a good one. And she chooses not to do the thing that her mother would have done.
Right. Instead, she breaks the plex with her sword, and she and Pyrrha are pulled out into the river, where they watch Ianthe save God and let Augustine get pulled into the stoma.
This is wild. Granted, not surprising for a few reasons. Why do you think Ianthe decided to save God and not Augustine?
I think that God is more important to Ianthe's plans than Augustine is. And more importantly, she knows that if God dies, then it's the same fear about Coronabeth. So she's both protecting Coronabeth. I think that she has some sort of agreement or something is going on between her and God. And it also might just be that God is vastly more powerful than Augustine, and she wants the most powerful person on her side. But I think it's mostly like Coronabeth slash her mysterious grand plan.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think it's this whole thing is complicated because I try and put myself in Ianthe's shoes. Maybe not even as Ianthe, not in Ianthe's shoes. I put myself in Ianthe's position. And I have the choice between killing God or killing Augustine. And my heart wants to kill John and save Augustine, but my brain wants to do otherwise. And thinking really big picture here, this isn't just about God dying and getting rid of this horrible person. If God dies, all the houses die along with it. That's a lot of people that are killed with God's death. And so is it worth murdering this horrible man, ridding the universe of necromancy, but also through that having to sacrifice all of these people on the houses? I think that I would choose to save God, not because I care about him, but because I would want to try to find another way out of this without murdering all the nine houses.
And that's coming from Mel, a person who could not be more different from Ianthe.
I would have made the same choice, maybe for different reasons, but mm-hmm. I definitely would have made the same choice.
Also, never forget that Augustine told Ianthe that she was bad at swords. So yeah. This could just be plain retribution.
Could be. Knowing Ianthe, that would definitely track.
And then, oh boy, we get the most confounding. I mean, the epilogue is one thing, but it's almost so confounding that without the context of the first couple of chapters of Nona, it's just like you couldn't even, it was absolutely incomprehensible. But this is really interesting. Gideon in Hera's body watches this happen, and then finally the pressure of the river makes her chest cave in, or at least she feels like that her chest is caving in. And right before she dies, she has this sort of monologue in her narration where she says, "Did you know that you see your life flash before your eyes? I wondered if it would be my life or your life," or like sort of the two of them on top of each other like we've always been. And instead of seeing Hera, she sees the body in the tomb. She sees Alecto. And then this body, who she realizes is Hera's ice girlfriend, says in the wrong voice, twice removed, chest compressions, we've got to get her heart pumping, blah, blah, blah. And then Gideon dies. It's okay.
Yeah. So on the first read, second read, third read, fourth read, if you haven't read the first six chapters of Nona, you will never know what this means. You can guess all you want, but you wouldn't really know. And even with reading the first six chapters of Nona, it's still not totally clear, though I have a theory that I will share. This is a heartbreaking way to end this chapter. This is also the last chapter in this book that we see Gideon, which is also just like sad in and of itself. All our hope of reuniting Gideon and Hera's situation kind of goes out the window at the end of this chapter. And we never trust the words, "we died." We cannot ever trust those words in these books. But I will say that as Gideon sees Alecto's body and she says in the wrong voice, twice removed, this chest compressions, I know her sternum shattered, etc. Here's what I think. I'm pretty sure that this is Palamedes speaking in Camilla's body. And the reason why I think that is, one, wrong voice twice removed. So Alecto is the body. Removed from that would be Camilla. Removed from that would be Palamedes. That's like 2 degrees of separation. It's the wrong voice, but it is Palamedes twice removed.
That makes sense. So she's seeing Alecto, but it's Camilla's voice, but it's speaking in the way that Palamedes would say something.
Exactly. That is what I think.
Interesting.
And the other clue here is that, like, this is obviously someone who knows medicine. Mm-hmm. And we know from our time with Camilla and Palamedes in Gideon the Ninth that medicine is very much part of their shtick. Again, this is just what I think. There's another clue to this in Nona, where at the end, I think, of the sixth chapter, when Camilla is telling the story to Nona of how they met. Like, I'm not going to go into the details of it because we're going to have a huge Nona to do after all of this. There's a moment in that sixth chapter that also leads me to believe that here, this is Palamedes and Camilla trying to revive Hera's body.
This makes sense. I am still confused about why she sees Alecto. I mean, if the person inside of Nona is Alecto, maybe it's more of a hallucination as their souls switch around.
Yeah, that is my theory, is that the reason she's seeing Alecto is because Alecto is now taking control of Hera's body. Where Gideon and Hera's souls go, TBD.
This is an excellent theory. I feel very, very good about it. Nice work.
Thanks. We'll see. Again, you couldn't really have a succinct theory until the Nona preview.
Right.
But here we are. We have the Nona preview, and soon we will have more so we can revisit this.
Oh, yeah. So we don't quite have an answer on that, but then we move into chapter 53. It's very short. It's a fractured ninth house skull, third person river bubble. It says half an hour ago. So this would presumably be sometime around when chapter 50 started-ish.
Right, which is when Gideon and Ianthe are making their way towards the Emperor's chambers right before shit hits the fan with all of them.
Right. And Dulcinea has just, if we remember from the last time we were in the river bubble, Dulcinea had said that she has something to tell Harrow. So she's just told Harrow something about her body and Gideon. And I assume it was something along the lines of Gideon's whole intact spirit is piloting your body right now. It's not like a remnant. It's Gideon is, in a way, totally alive and running your body. And I was the only person who could have seen this because I have the right expertise. Abigail didn't see it. And I just want to tell you the truth so that you know the whole truth going into it. So like you're not kicking out a little fragment of Gideon, like Gideon is there in your body. And obviously this changes everything for Harrow. And one of the best Harrow lines in this book is her response to this. She says, so if you remember, Magnus told that story about how he saved a ripped piece of Abigail's dance card when they broke up when they were like 17 or something.
Wow, I did not make that connection. Thank you for that. Yes.
Yeah. And so Harrow, in a callback to that moment, says there's a difference between keeping a shred of dance card and saving the last dance. I just choked up. Whew.
Wow.
I mean, that's a good ass line.
Wow. Right. And so what she's saying here is, no, I'm not just like holding on to a little bit of what I've got because I'm not ready to let go.
Right.
It's like, oh, no, no. Like, Gideon is alive.
Right. Gideon's alive. She has a body. It's my body. And if I go back, she dies again. And Dulcinea leaves. And Harrow says, no, I'm getting out of here, and pops the bubble. And if you think back to the last time we were in this bubble, and she was saying the needle was slowly pointing more and more towards yes, like, yes, I'm going to go back to my body. We see in this moment that Harrow has decided, no, she's not going to go back to her body. She's getting out of here. She pops the bubble. And then I feel like the end of these two chapters are like, we have no idea where Gideon and Harrow have ended up. Because Harrow pops the bubble, and all of a sudden she's walking down her long, dark corridor. The one that we've been talking about this whole time. Like, is it metaphorical? Is it a literal thing? And then she's in the water being held by Gideon back in Canaan House. You know, the pool scene. And then she's in the water in the sort of moat around the tomb on the ninth house. And she swims to the mausoleum in the middle of this lake where the body is laid. And she walks to the tomb and it's empty. And in the bottom of the coffin or sarcophagus or whatever is Gideon's two-hander. And for some reason, she lays down in the coffin. And it's very comfy. She like is feeling pretty good, like tired, but good. And she finds in the bottom of the coffin, along with the sword, is a magazine entitled Frontline Titties of the Fifth.
Yes. I love that Frontline Titties of the Fifth came back full circle right at the close of this book. So good.
And this is the reason why I don't, there was a part of me that when I read this, I was like, maybe there's been a switch. And now Harrow is in Electo's body in the coffin, literally. But this looks more like a river bubble or some other type of made up world. Because as we know, Frontline Titties of the Fifth is not a real publication. So this can't be real.
So what we know about river bubbles is that everything that you bring in there, like you have to have comprehended, right, yourself. So whose Frontline Titties of the Fifth is this? Is this Gideon's Frontline Titties of the Fifth? Or is this Harrow's creating Frontline Titties of the Fifth? Like, Whose frontline titties of the fifth magazine is this?
This is the question we've all been asking. I thought this is what I thought happened. I thought that Gideon was basically, when Gideon says that she kept on being dunked in the water and then brought back up to the surface, I thought that maybe it was literally like in this bubble or something, tomb, shadow world, and that she had her sword and her frontline titties of the fifth to keep her company. And now Harrow has basically gone to where Gideon has been these last 10 months or so. And that's why those things are there. That's what my read was. I feel like we could talk about this for forever, but I think one thing we definitely know is that it says at the end of this that Harrow falls asleep or drops dead. Dude, she's not dead. Neither is Gideon. Everyone's alive. And they're all coming back.
Yeah, definitely everyone. Definitely. I couldn't agree more. In fact, I would bet painting my naked body with a skeleton running down the streets of New York City that these two people are very much alive.
Their spirits are alive.
Yeah, their spirits are alive. I had the same read as you. I think that this is like where Gideon's been hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
Just nice and safe. And that like Harrow's either consciously or subconsciously did create this actual river bubble. Because for her, it is one of the safest places one can be. And so she tucked Gideon nice and safely there. And now Harrow's back. The mm-hmm. question is, where is Gideon? We don't know.
Gideon is haunting the sword in the river bubble. Then there's an interesting bit that says at the very end of this, it says, then there was a huge side-to-side rocking in the manner of an explosion or a cradle. Her eyes close, lying in the tomb that claimed her heart, far away in a land she had never traveled. Harrowhark Nonagesimus fell asleep or dropped dead or both. Eovol, the huge side-to-side rocking. I figured it was when Augustine drops him in the river. If you think about the timeline, this would be the moment that Augustine drops them in the river, more or less.
Okay.
And I feel like that kind of matches up.
Sure.
I have almost no evidence for this, but that was my thought.
I like it. If not like that exact moment, it could be when Gideon smashes through the window and they get like sucked out, right?
Or her chest caves in.
Or her chest, right? I think the function of throwing this in here is to say that Harrow is still somehow tied to her body. It's not like Harrow has left.
Yes.
So that makes sense. What I find very interesting, I'm not going to go into this. People have lots of opinions about this. But it says, lying in the tomb that had claimed her heart, far away in a land she had never traveled.
Mm-hmm.
A land she had never traveled. I mean, Harrow has traveled this land, supposedly. But here, we're saying, like, actually she hasn't. There is a whole theory around where the locked tomb actually is and that it actually isn't in the ninth house, that it is, I think, at Canaan House. Again, I'm not going to dive in. I don't remember all the arguments for that other theory. But here is a moment where we could question, like, where actually is this? And was Harrow ever really there? Who's to say? But this faraway land she had never traveled is very curious to me.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, there's so much to unpack here. And thank the goddess we are getting Nona soon. Otherwise, I think I might just like spiral out of control.
Yep. So let's go through the epilogue quickly, because I feel like the epilogue could be in Nona. That's what it feels like. And since we're going to get it in like 2 seconds... we'll just kind of talk about what we know from the first six chapters that makes this make more sense. So in the epilogue, a mysterious person is talking about her life living in what seems to be modern day Earth.
Yes. I think what's really fucking jarring about this epilogue is that it feels like it's not in the nine houses. And actually, I don't think it is.
Oh, definitely not.
It's like, wait, what? Now we're in a modern, what feels like a modern day city. I thought we were sword fighting and playing in space. And now we're just like in a weird apartment. It's wild.
It's weird. It says she lived with three people, the person who went to work for her, the person who taught her, and the person who looked after her. And we know, having read the first six chapters of Nona, that Pyrrha is the person who went to work for her. Palamedes is the person who taught her, and Camilla is the person who looked after her. And Palamedes and Camilla are both in Camilla's body. They've achieved some sort of perfect lictorhood, although just one body. And Palamedes is giving her bones to hold, and Camilla is giving her a sword to hold. And it talks about how at the end of the day, when it's late, they'll go and get some freaking hush puppies from a bodega. In the past, they went to a different bodega that had even better hush puppies, but she like didn't burn her mouth once when it was really hot, and the bodega owner commented on it. So now they can't go back. And finally, we learn that this is sort of a war-torn city. There are soldiers everywhere, and that on some nights they have to lie on the floor in the bathroom while there are gunfights outside. And the last lines of this freaking book are this mysterious person says, "Have you worked out who I am?" Followed up by the extremely infuriating, "Not yet," said Camilla.
Oh my God. I can't believe how long we've been waiting to figure this shit out. But I can tell you, I've read this epilogue at least like 22 times.
Oh yeah.
Just the epilogue. To be like, what is this? What's happening here?
I know. And it's funny because now that we've read the first little bit of Nona, a lot of our questions about who is answered. And it just makes me so excited because I just feel like so many of our questions will be answered. And I have the old version of the book where it says the tomb will open in Electo the Ninth. So this was before Nona was going to be a thing.
You want to know what the more recent version says?
What?
My version of the paperback is sooner, and it says Gideon will return in Nona the Ninth.
What? That's wild. Oh my gosh, what a giveaway. So I guess we'll see Gideon again. What a surprise. LOL not.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, guys. That's Harrow the Ninth. My favorite book. My favorite book that I've ever read.
Favorite book of all time.
I have a feeling that Harrow will be my favorite book of this series.
Yeah, it's hard to top. I mean, this is by far my favorite series. I haven't made a podcast about another series.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably talk about our theories for Nona forever, but the truth is we're going to release this weekend, just days before Nona comes out. So hopefully this can get you through those like final 24 hours before our lives are changed forever.
Amy, I had a thought.
What?
That we will have to re-record all of a Harrow reread after Nona comes out, because like
a Harrow reread?
Yeah, a Harrow reread. Uh-huh. Because there's going to be so many perspective shifts. Which is cool. We're not actually going to do that, but we will have a lot more time to go through things as we're all discovering the next book together.
That sounded really romantic. Yeah, so this is our last episode covering the main book of Harrow the Ninth, although we will have an extra episode covering As Yet Unsent in the next couple of weeks. We'll also record a first thoughts episode after we've both read Nona, which I assume will be on Wednesday. I mean, we won't record on Wednesday, but I'm going to read it very quickly through the night. And then once, you know, we've gotten to the point where we feel like most people have read Nona and really had time to like take it in, maybe at the end of October or the beginning of November, we'll start a full Nona reread. In the meantime, we will do a couple of fun episodes, maybe talking about some questions that we had in Harrow and Gideon that were answered in Nona. We might read some audience questions and answer those. But we're so excited to start what is basically season 3.
Yeah. But the goal will be to like move through Nona a little bit more slowly as we build towards the release of Electo next year. I am so excited.
Yeah. So if you guys have also any other ideas for things to cover, let us know. But in the meantime, happy Nonaine to you all. As always, if you like this podcast, share it with your friends. I'm switching it up. So share it with your friends. Your friends may hate lesbian necromancers in space. If so, why are you friends with them? But do share it. Also rate and review us. And if you have any questions or comments, as always, please send us a question on our website, locktombpod.com, or on Twitter at locktombpod. We're especially interested in your Nona questions once you've finished the book, because we'll start to answer listener questions starting in our very next episode. As always, thank you to Olivia Kay for our theme music. I am Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locked Tomb Podcast.